Welcome back, everyone, to Constructive Uncoupling, the podcast devoted to amicable divorces. I'm Judy Weigel, your host and amicable divorce expert. Why? Because that's all I do, amicable divorces. Today, we have the longest running guest we've ever had on this show, Warren Scheel, attorney, phenomenal attorney in family law. Not only did we have Warren talking about prenuptial agreements, but Warren has brought with him over the last two episodes, this will be the third, exceptional guests. Today, we have Umberto Gray, who is an immigration law attorney. His firm is Gray Law, and Warren, of course, his firm is in the name of his name, and we'll give you all that information at the end of the show. Interestingly about Umberto, and we're going to talk about immigration law, current events, and how it's affecting divorce, but Umberto has some of the most famous clients in entertainment and business you could ever imagine. Billy Idol, Ziggy Marley, Jerry Buss. I mean, the list goes on and on. So, Umberto, I'm asking you this question. Why did you choose celebrities? Is it because of what we learned on the Rocky and Bullwinkle film when they were, when Whoopi Goldberg was the judge and they had committed some kind of crime and she said, you know, you're free to go because celebrities are above the law? Is that why, Umberto?
Well, that happens once in a while. Thank you so much, Judy, for having me. I really appreciate it. And Warren, thank you for the invite.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's been an interesting practice over 35 years now. Gosh, I'm getting pretty old. You know, my specialty started when I was actually in law school in 1985 before I passed the bar. And I had a good friend who, his dream was to be a sports agent. And so he went over to IMG, International Management Group, and he became a big agent. So I played baseball in college, and my family's from the Dominican Republic. He calls me one day out of the blue when I was in law school, my second year, and he says, hey, Umberto, you know anything about getting a visa for a big 7'2" basketball player from Russia who's playing for the Atlanta Hawks? And, you know, initially I wasn't going to practice immigration law at all, but it dawned on me that day. I said, wow, what a fantastic practice that would be. And I told him, I said, look, I'll get the visa, I'll do the research, I'll figure it out. I did so, and when I passed the bar, IMG was my first client, and I was getting, you know, professional foreign golfers into the U.S., basketball players, Eastern European countries, race car drivers, etc. So it's been a really rewarding practice, but most importantly, a lot of fun.
And but with that, I noticed that you do a lot of pro bono work for those who are not that wealthy and that simply need help. So you give back to the community, do you not?
Absolutely. I've done work for the DACA kids, the deferred action kids who, you know, who were brought here by their parents illegally when they were young. And I got to tell you, these kids are fantastic. I've done maybe 100 cases. All of which these kids are doing amazing things. They're graduating from Stanford, Harvard, UCLA. They are the cream of the crop. And I was so happy recently that the Supreme Court indicated that the administration did not properly attempt to rescind the DACA and it was still in place. And so now I have another 50 cases on my desk that I'm waiting to get filed, and it's fantastic.
So, Umberto, if I can jump in there, about that Supreme Court case, what is the administration now planning on doing? Because I understood the Supreme Court left the door open for them to take further action and either, you know, restrict DACA kids.
So it's interesting. The administration let the time clock lapse on when they should respond. They have not responded. And in fact, the administration has been saying openly that they want to give the DACA kids a path to U.S. citizenship, which means they may, in fact, get green cards. So it's a real big turn of events. it's wonderful for the DACA kids. And, you know, I'm hoping that happens because, yeah, they deserve it.
All right. So, and welcome, Warren, by the way. Warren comes from the divorce capital of the world, I understand, London. You told me that, right?
That's the divorce capital. And thanks for the introduction, Judith. You make me feel like the Rodney Dangerfield of guests here. I'm going to go for that record. I think you know who I'm referring to. He was on Johnny Carson's show like 50 times or something.
Yes, he was. And I would love you to hold that record because not only are you smart, you are really funny. So please make us laugh anytime you want.
I'll try.
But let's follow up on the DACA, because one of my questions, current events, immigration and divorce, was, well, what if the administration was successful getting these DACA kids deported? And what if they were in the middle of divorce? What would happen to them?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I want to hear from Umberto what he has to say about that.
Well, no, I think it's a great question. You know, the DACA deferred action is conferred on the individual, so they have a deferred status where they couldn't be deported. So if that's taken away and they're being deported and they're currently in the middle of a divorce, the divorce proceedings would have to yield to the federal deportation laws, because a judge is not going to delay a deportation based on the fact that a divorce is pending. Could you expedite that divorce based upon that fact pattern?
Well, I mean, it depends who you're representing. You may not want to expedite it. I think what the point that Umberto is making is that the immigration case takes precedence in the sense that the immigration court's not going to defer to a family court or delay anything based on the family court proceedings. But then you have to look at the facts on the ground. What's going to happen if the children... with or without their parents are sent back to another country. Under the UCCJA, I think you would then have a situation where there was a divorce with custody proceedings that have been initiated in Los Angeles. Okay, so the Los Angeles or California initially had jurisdiction because the children and the family were living in California. So then the children moved back to another country. And then... what usually happens is an analysis to determine whether the new country has jurisdiction. And I think what would happen is someone would make a motion, either in Los Angeles or in the new country, to say that the new country was the more convenient forum. That because the children are now living in another country, that other countries' courts are a more convenient jurisdiction to hear the custody case. I think that's what would happen.
And so it would be the... Warren, let me ask you a question. So the converse would be true, correct? If the parent was divorced, but the kids were born in the U.S. and they were U.S. citizens, and perhaps they had joint custody, would jurisdiction still lie in the U.S.?
Well, in that case, yes. I mean, under the UCCJA, the Jurisdictional Act, decides which state or which country has jurisdiction to decide custody. And as a general rule, we look at where the children have been residing for at least 6 months. So the children are living in California, and then one or both parents, I mean, presumably one parent, is then sent back to another country. California would retain jurisdiction in that situation. And then the court has a very difficult decision to make as to where the children will live in the future. Will the children continue to reside in California, or should the judge make an order that the children should move back to that other country? And there's all kinds of factors that are relevant to the children's best interests. And that's the guideline that the court uses, what is in the children's best interests.
Warren, could you explain the acronym that you've used a couple times, UCCJEA, for the audience?
It's the Uniform Custody... I just refer to the Uniform Custody Jurisdiction Act, and that's an abbreviation.
So it's a document that states where the children have lived for the past 5 years, and it supports where they live. That's the important part of it, right?
Yeah, I mean, someone's got to decide which court has jurisdiction. The full title of the statute is the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction and Enforcement Act. And each state in the union has a version of that. It was decided on a federal level, and then each state implements a version of that act. And it's to make sure that there are no conflicts between different states. So there is a procedure to decide which state has jurisdiction. Doesn't mean that families or parents don't litigate that, because often there's a good strategic reasons why you might want to litigate in another state as opposed to California.
Okay, now you both brought up something that I wanted to ask about, and you used the word deportation, and that's the biggest fear, of course, and we've seen that happen 2-3 years ago, lots of deportation cases going down. So let's just say husband is picked up by ICE, is in a deportation facility in the United States, wife now wants to file for divorce. Can she serve husband in the deportation facility?
That's a good question. She does have access to visits, so yes, she would be able to serve him while he was in deportation in custody, absolutely. By the way, Judith, they call it removal proceedings these days. It's no longer really called deportation proceedings. It's called removal. Kind of a nicer word, you know, used.
Yes, because all the words we use in law are a little rough. Okay, so we'll use the word removal. Thank you for that. Warren, here's a question for you. Okay, so if husband is served in the removal facility, can he file a response to the petition?
Wow. I mean, look, you're asking me questions that haven't come up and hopefully will not come up in the near or far future. One of the things is when you're serving papers, whether it's the petition or the response, is that the service has to be done by someone who's over the age of 18 who's not a party to the action. So the wife in that situation would have to bring someone with her to the facility to serve the husband. And some one of the aspects of jurisdiction is what we call personal jurisdiction, and that is service. So if there's proper service of the other person, then you fulfill one of those jurisdictional elements of personal jurisdiction, that you serve that person. Well, that's a good question. I guess the removal, Umberto, the removal facilities in California, I suppose that if someone's picked up in California, will they stay in California or will they get sent somewhere else?
Yeah, right now there's such a backlog and an overflow of these cases. I mean, they could be sent to Arizona, Texas. Yeah. They could be sent to a lot of different venues in terms of housing while they're waiting for their deportation hearing.
So I guess then if they're sent to Arizona, then you have a jurisdictional issue about proper service because you're serving them in another state.
Gotcha.
It's kind of
but
interesting.
Ultimately, if their removal proceeding commences in front of the immigration judge and they're just being housed temporarily,
yeah,
they will move them back to the courts. And the courts, it is an open proceeding where, you know, anyone can come and be present. So,
okay.
You know, they could probably effectuate service in that manner during the actual removing proceeding in front of the judge.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And the wife, in my theoretical example, the wife would know where husband is, right? Wouldn't she be told?
That's a good question. She certainly could find out, I mean, just by calling a removal hotline number, and it will indicate if she has his what's called an A number, that's the green card number, she can find out exactly where he is and when his next hearing will be.
I know this is a really finite point of law, but I just want to pursue one more question in the removal aspect, and that is, we, as a point of law, when a petition is served on the respondent has X number of days to respond. I went through this in a similar situation when I served people in jail. Nobody ever filed a response, but somebody asked me recently, well, can a response be filed by somebody who's in jail? Now, I think this is even more important because if you're getting deported, it means you're not legally in the United States, correct? Or you've committed a crime against your and it's affected your immigration status? These are the reasons why you would be removed, Umberto?
Yeah, there's various reasons why one can be removed. There's, you know, over 100 different reasons one can be removed. But when they're in removal proceedings, they are deemed still in the U.S. And it's only until they are removed and physically sent outside of the borders that they're no longer in the U.S.
Okay, but if you are being removed, does that take any legal rights away from you in a divorce proceeding to be able to file a response?
I think that's a question for Warren. I mean, unless, perhaps they have an attorney as good as Warren that could draft the response and certainly could go to the place of housing or to the removal proceeding and have him sign, I guess that's plausible.
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert, and you use the analogy of a prisoner, someone in jail. And there are various, if you go online, there are various groups that provide manuals that assist people on divorcing while you're in jail. So there's actually, a well-defined procedure and protocol for divorcing in jail. I don't know if that's true in these detention facilities. I mean, from what I've seen on the news, it seems like there's no procedures and protocols for anything. So I'd be very surprised if you get served with a petition for divorce and then you go to speak to the supervisor, whoever's, you know, I don't know what you call those people, detention officers, and say, I need to file a California response to a dissolution, FL 120 and a 105, they probably just look at you and say, that's too bad. I mean, there's nothing we can do about that. I don't know. I mean, there must be, are there groups that go into these places and help people with legal problems?
Well, yeah, they do have, you know, pro bono service. I've never, you know, run into a situation where someone's getting divorced while they're, you know, in removal proceedings. I've never really experienced that. Not to say that it doesn't happen, but, you know, there is access to the public. And the reality is they only house, you know, the really hard criminals that are kept into custody and can't have a bond posted. You know, most are able to get out within, I would say, 30 days. You know, a bond is posted, and they depart. And then as long as they see the judge, when the judge calls them, they're okay.
Well, let me tell you something that came up in my office yesterday. I was meeting with a young lady on a paternity case, not immigration, but her mom came with her. And her mom said, my husband and I, 20 years ago, started with divorce proceedings. We got halfway through. We were supposed to put a settlement agreement together, and he got removed. And she kind of knows where he is in South America, could more than likely find him through relatives. But how do you finish a divorce if it's even allowed to remain open halfway through when your spouse is now in another country and removed?
There is a procedure called publication. That if you show the court you've used it. So let me back up somewhat. If you know where the person is living, there are usually procedures governed by the Hague Convention on Service Abroad. And so you go to court, get an order, and then you can serve proceedings on that person in the other country. It's usually through an embassy or a consul. You think they're in another country, but you don't know where they are. You make a good faith effort to try and find them, then you can go to court and get an order that you can publish the divorce petition.
Right, but they already filed. They got halfway through, and then he got removed.
Well, there's also a 5-year statute of limitations, so the thing is dismissed, so they may have to start the entire process all over again. Right. And I think that the place to go, I think that often Levitt and Quinn or Harriet Buhai do a lot of those kind of cases involving Mexican nationals.
Okay, very good. What are the most fearful issues surrounding a divorce with a foreign national and a U.S. citizen? What are those things that always come up that are of concern?
Not getting paid.
Well, that's for you.
Okay, that's an attorney joke, okay? And it doesn't enamor you to the public, right?
Yes, it does.
I'm brutally honest. I'm going to be brutally honest on this one.
Well, Warren, I always get paid up front, so.
There you go. He's a smart man. He's a smart businessman.
That's never a problem for me. Well, I got to tell you, the biggest issue that comes up in my practice is there's so much going on in a divorce, and then there's so much going on in their immigration, process that everything gets jumbled up. And so they're having a hard time already. And so what I always advise my clients, I say, do what you're going to do from, a legal divorce. Do what you're going to do, not thinking about the immigration. If you're going to do it, do it. Just handle both separately. So you tell me what you want to do on the divorce end, and then I'll handle the immigration component of it. And, a lot of times, there may be negative ramifications, for the foreign national in the middle of a divorce. If they're in the middle, for example, of their, immediate relative spousal petition and, divorce is started, well, guess what? The foreign national is not getting a green card and may have to depart the U.S. And that, that could be really difficult, for the foreign national. But, it is what it is. It's very confusing. It's such a hard time for them. But what I advise is just separate the two and do what you need to do.
And can you talk about that two-year mark? That comes up in my office a lot. I bet it does for you as well, Warren.
Sure. So the two-year mark is at the time of your first interview for the green card, if you are married less than 2 years, then you get a conditional green card. And that conditional green card is good for 2 years, where you have to file a second application and you have to prove that the marriage was valid, right? So at the time of the first interview, if your marriage was beyond the two-year period, then you get the permanent green card. You don't get a conditional green card, it's permanent.
So there's less fear getting divorced when you've been married more than 2 years. Is that fair to say?
Well, no. I would say if you are in the process of getting the permanent green card and you get divorced before the final interview, then it's going to be very difficult to get the green card. As opposed to, let's say, you were not married for 2 years at the time of the first interview. You got the conditional green card. A year later, you filed for divorce. Now there is a procedure called a waiver. You can file a waiver, show that the marriage was entered into in good faith, and you can still get the permanent green card. Does that make sense?
It does. Warren, how have you dealt with this? Does this come up very often for you?
It comes up once in a while. And this is one of those situations where a good family lawyer, the most important thing they know is who to talk to. So in that kind of situation, I know Umberto. I call Umberto. And that's the most important thing, is to know what you don't know and draw on that kind of expertise. Because these are very, the family lawyer can't know everything. And so these are very, you're going back to your early question, the most difficult thing in these kind of cases are always the children. And if the foreign national has to return, the question's going to be, where did the children go? And so that's the most painful decision that parents have to make. And so I think that custody, from my perspective, custody drives these cases. So the decisions are based upon custody.
Well, it's interesting, Warren. Even though I haven't been retained yet, you and I have a real life case right now going on.
Hopefully.
Just those issues. We won't say names or anything, but.
Yeah, and afterwards we're going to have a chat because this is coming up. And you know, it's interesting, and I hope opposing counsel's not listening to this. But and actually, my wife made a very good point. And my wife's not an attorney, but she gets to the heart of the matter. And in the family code, the legislatures in Sacramento decided there's a provision that when you decide custody, the court's not allowed to take into account immigration status.
Wow.
Okay?
Wow.
So the question is, how does that play out in a best interest analysis? If the choice is between the children going back to a country where they can have all kinds of benefits, they can go to school, they can get their health service paid for, they can get their college paid for, as opposed to staying in the U.S. where they may not have any of those benefits. You know,
what's the rationale? What's the rationale for that, Warren? Why wouldn't they take into account immigration? I mean, that's important.
You know, good question. I really haven't gone into the legislative history on that. But it's there in black and white. It's in the family code.
Wow.
Now, in some areas, it is relevant. So, for example, in an abduction case, the family code says that you can take into account immigration status because obviously that will be a relevant factor in weighing the risk of abduction. But in determining best interests of custody, you're not supposed to take that into account. So that's a good question. I need to go and do some research on that one.
So yeah, Warren, let me ask you a question. So what if one spouse is not allowed to stay in the U.S. because of the immigration status? I mean, a judge won't look at that and say, "Well, wait a minute. Let me take into account, you know, this piece of evidence in terms of custody because this foreign national is not going to be here."
Well, there's a very famous case. Yeah, there was the Hamda a couple of years ago, and what the judge did look at was the circumstances giving rise to that immigration status. It was a very famous actress, and she was American living in Los Angeles. The father, I believe, was from Monte Carlo or France, and he was also, I believe, Interpol had a red flag on him, and there's some, you know, he was wanted in various European countries. So the wife's attorney, and this is all public information, the wife's attorney contacted INS and he got deported. And that her action in deporting him was a factor that was taken into account in deciding best interest and custody. Mm-hmm. She'd acted in bad faith. And so gotcha. Custody was actually awarded to the father. And he went back to Monte Carlo or wherever in Europe. And that was a factor. So in that sense, immigration status per se was not considered, but the actions of the mother and the wife in precipitating that crisis was mm-hmm. taken into account.
Interesting.
Okay, so child custody being one of the most difficult things in a foreign national divorce. Warren and Umberto, what are family petitions in the world of immigration?
So in the world of immigration, I mean, family petitions are immediate relative petitions. That is husband, wife, children under 21 are considered immediate relatives, and there's no waiting period. On the other hand, sometimes you have preference categories. Let's say one U.S. citizen is applying for a sibling, you know, that's a preference category under the fourth family preference category. You know, that petition could take, it's subject to numerical limitations. So that could take somewhere up to 10 years, you know, from start to finish to get the green card. But yeah, there's basically, you know, four categories in family law in terms of immigration. Would you like to know what those are?
Yes. Yes.
So the first category is for unmarried sons and daughters of U.S. citizens over 21. The second category, spouses and children, unmarried children of permanent residents. The third category, married sons and daughters of U.S. citizens. And the fourth category is for siblings. And then there is an immediate relative category that I spoke about that's not subject to numerical limitation, that's spouses and children under 21 of U.S. citizens.
So you know what I'm thinking as I'm listening to both of you talk, and especially what you just said, Umberto? I'm thinking that when a divorce is imminent, people need to do some research on how divorce and immigration affect them. They really need to spend some time on this more than they need to come to me or Warren first. Don't they need to really research immigration?
Absolutely, Judith. You know, I have a situation where, you know, a neighbor's nanny, I decided I was going to help out, right? I was going to help get her daughters into the U.S. from Guatemala. And so I went on that endeavor, and years went by, and we filed under one category when they were unmarried, and she never told me when they got married, which changed the category substantially. And so we had to start again. We filed again. Years later, she told me, oh, she's married again. And it was just a mess, Judith. I mean, you know, when I explained to my clients initially, those who listen, look, you have to tell me, you know, when you're married and when you're not married, because it's a different category and it could, you know, negatively affect your immigration status. So it happens all the time.
And, you know, Warren, people lie all the time. I mean, people lie out of fear. Maybe they don't mean to lie, but they come in to work on a divorce and they just don't tell you everything, which is the worst thing they could do, right?
Well, I think, so number one, they lie. I think when you initially meet the client, you explain to them that everything they tell you is covered by the attorney-client privilege. So everything they tell you is going to be confidential. And so hopefully that gives them a level of comfort that they will tell you the truth. I think a bigger problem is sometimes it just doesn't occur to them to tell you something. And Umberto kind of touched upon that. And we as lawyers, you know, everything that has a legal consequence or repercussion, you know, it seems to us obvious that we would tell our attorney or tell our expert or advisor that information. But a lot of people don't go through life like that. They just swim through life and things happen to them. And then only after the event do they realize they've made a mistake or they need to fix a problem. And that's when they go and see a lawyer or an accountant,
right,
or someone, or, you know, professional.
Gentlemen, I wish we could continue, but in the interest of full disclosure, we're doing this on Zoom and I have seconds left on this recording because I couldn't upgrade the five times I tried to call. So I want to thank you for being here. We're going to do this again. Umberto Gray, Gray Law, Umberto, G-R-A-Y, Gray Law, Warren Scheel Law. And I thank both of you for being here.